From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. As of last year, 17% of doctors practicing in Georgia were born outside of the United States. On Monday, we'll discuss whether foreign-born doctors could help alleviate the healthcare worker shortage in Georgia and the red tape that keeps many of them from practicing in the U.S. I'd love to know from you, should restrictions on practitioners ease up, or are you concerned about relaxing regulations? Well, you can let us know. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, on Facebook, and on Second Thought. And you can send us an email to onsecondthought@gpb.org or call us at 404-500-9457. And make sure to join us for that conversation on Monday. The Bitter Southerner celebrated its fifth anniversary this year. We just heard about its first ever book publication. Well, now it is launching the Bitter Southerner podcast in collaboration with GPB. The first episode comes out on Monday. Bitter Southerner Editor-in-Chief Chuck Reese joins me in the studio with a little preview and a look back at how much the online publication has grown since 2013. Chuck, congratulations.
Oh, thank you, Virginia. It's good to be here.
Well, glad to have you with us. You joined On Second Thought many times to talk about, you know, various Southern isms, but never about the Bitter Southerner itself. So how did it all begin?
Well, it all began with cocktails in New Orleans.
As so many things do.
Right, yeah. Now, back in 2011, my then fiance, now wife, Stacy, and I went to New Orleans for Halloween week, and I'd gotten a little fascinated with the sort of resurgence of proper bartending, and we spent time with two or three great bartenders who had never stopped doing it right, and about a week after that, I got home and I saw this list from a trade magazine about the 50 best cocktail bars in the world, and I thought, well, maybe that place we went to in New Orleans will be on this list. And I read the list, and there was not only no New Orleans bars in it, but none of no bars in the American South, period.
No kidding, huh?
Yeah. And so I came home wanting to do a little cocktail blog and went to work with my now partner, Dave Whitling, who designs the Bitter Southerner and makes it look so beautiful. And I told him I wanted to do this blog and asked him, would he design it for me? And so we went off and did a little naming exercise using the various ingredients that you can put in a cocktail, one of which is bitters. And we were like, the booze Southerner, the bourbon Southerner, the bitter Southerner. When we hit that, we were like, whoa, that's like a quadruple entendre. And we actually took a year after that moment trying to figure out what the name was telling us to do. And it really scratched an itch that I'd always had because my first job in journalism was covering the media industry for Adweek magazine back in the 80s. And I used to see all the network television pilots and magazine prototypes from the big publishing companies. And every time I saw something that was set in the South or purported to cover the South, I only saw a couple of stereotypes, you know, and the easiest way to say it probably is one looked like the party scene from the beginning of Gone with the Wind, except maybe with updated clothing. And the other one looked like, you know, from my childhood, the Beverly Hillbillies to like Duck Dynasty most recently. And those two stereotypes just didn't fit the South that I grew up in and knew. And I'd always wanted a publication to try to get beyond that, and, you know, the means of entry were not too high because one no longer needed paper and ink to print a magazine. So we just took a shot at it, and we were able to do it for the first 52 weeks in a row, paying no one anything. We had so many wonderful writers and photographers who I imagine just felt like the thing should exist. And they threw in, and then starting with our first anniversary, we knew we would need to keep doing it. And we tried to start turning it into a business. And, you know, we're sort of almost getting there now.
Well, and its appeal, you have members supporting it all over the world, actually.
This is true.
It just celebrated 5 years, as we said. Now you're collaborating with GPB to create this podcast. So why make a podcast? I mean, what does this add to the many zillions of choices in the podcast universe?
Well, you know, our stories on the website have been multimedia for a long time. You know, when some of the very first stories we did had, you know, short films and
great photography.
Yeah.
Beautifully laid out.
That's Dave. God bless Dave. But we had all that stuff together, but we'd always felt that we would like to get out into different mediums, you know. And since we began the process of doing this podcast in co-production with GPB, I've found something that I didn't expect.
What's that?
Well, I had always said to people, you know, if you read one or two or three of our stories from the past 5 years, that's not going to give you a complete picture of the 21st century South. But if you dive in and read like a dozen of them, it might. And what doing this podcast allows us to do is to sort of connect the dots between different stories that we have written in the past and things that are coming up, you know, to talk about larger issues like the role that music has played in the development of Southern culture, or that food has played in the development of Southern culture. And I found myself getting really excited by that opportunity.
Well, let's hear a little bit of this. This is from the first episode that's coming out on Monday. Here's a tease.
You know this groove, don't you? Most everybody knows it. But when I ask people who made the record, I usually get blank stares. Well, the name of the song is Green Onions, and the band is Booker T and the MGs. And to me, the MGs exemplify the very best of Southern culture. They represented what happens when Southerners are willing to cross the barriers of race and class that have kept our region's people apart for so long. In 1962.
There we go. A little taste of the first episode of the Bitter Southerner podcast. Pick it up from there if you don't mind, Chuck. You know, a little more about legendary backing band and their own recording band, Booker T and the MGs. And why do they represent the very best of Southern culture?
I have always believed. Maybe always is not right, but for a long, long time, I have believed that the greatest landmarks of Southern culture in terms of what we've contributed to the nation have happened when people disregarded the barriers of race and class.
We just heard that about the photographs of Joseph Shipp's granddad.
Well, that's one of the reasons that we wanted to make that book happen. But, you know, I've just always felt like the MGs were the patron saint of that idea, because you know, they were young men in Memphis, and in the late 50s and early 1960s, two of them black, two of them white, couldn't walk down the street together, couldn't go have a meal together, couldn't do anything that Jim Crow wouldn't allow, but they could go into that studio together. And, you know, the world still dances to the grooves that they made, not just, you know, their solo instrumental songs like Green Onions, but if you're dancing to Otis Redding, you know, if you're dancing to Carla Thomas, you're dancing to the MGs.
Oh, that Stax record stuff.
They were the house band at Stax, yeah.
Well, you asked some very big questions in this first episode, too. What do people mean when they say folk music? What does that mean to you as a consumer of culture and editor and chief of The Bitter Southerner?
Well, I've always thought folk music was kind of a weird term, you know, because most people think of it as a genre, and it implies earnestly sung songs of purpose
Peter, Paul, and Mary come to mind for me.
Exactly. Performed on acoustic instruments, you know. And, you know, I always thought folk music was just music for folks. It's like, you know, it's music that expresses the tribulations and the aspirations of ordinary people. And so one of the issues that we explore in the first episode of the podcast is how Southern hip-hop music over the last 20 years has essentially become the folk music of young African Americans in the South.
Well, here is Georgia Tech professor Jocelyn Wilson helping you expand on that using Spodeyote Dopealicious from OutKast. Here's her take.
Here you have a young man who applies for a job at UPS, but it comes back that his urine isn't clean or his urine is dirty. And so he's right back in the same environment, trapped. And he says, go on, marinate on that for a minute.
Now you back in the trap, just that. Trap. Go on to marinate on that for a minute.
That's a thought process around who the folk are and what the struggle is in the music. And I use that song because it gives us a clear access point to understanding what the South really has to say about living in the South and being Black and playing politics and doing the things that Black people have had to do since we've been in the South.
That is just a clip from the new Bitter Southerner podcast. We're just 2 days away from the launch, and Chuck Reese, editor-in-chief of the Bitter Southerner, is my guest, talking about the magazine's origins and also a little preview of that podcast first season. All right, so first episode, music. Second, food. Southern food as a political statement. In one conversation, you asked John T. Edge, he's a food historian and writer, whether the history of Southern food is racist. Here's just a little of what he said.
If we talk about racism, we're really talking about white imprint on Black culture and the ways in which white people and white supremacy have negatively impacted and thwarted Black people in Black culture. But if you flip it and you center the story of the South on Black triumph and Black creativity, you tell a whole different story of the South and you center it on people of color.
So a flip in the script, I guess, on history, certainly. And John T. also talked with you about being a white man empowered by white supremacy, even if he rejects the notion of it. So how is this made, these kinds of conversations, Chuck, and the stories that you've written and that you've edited, how have they helped you reckon with your whiteness and its inherent privilege?
Every story we do, almost, forces me to confront that. And increasingly so since the country took an interesting turn in 2016. I think it's really important in this day and age in particular for storytellers and people, particularly those who are editors or curators of stories written by other people. They need to really look at how we fairly address the issues that face all kinds of people who live in the region that we cover, you know? And it's really important to flip that script. I'll give you an example. The Grammy nominations came out this morning, and one of the nominees for Best Traditional Blues Album is a man named Cedric Burnside, who is...
son of R.L. Burnside? Son
of the grandson of R.L. Burnside. Cedric started playing drums in R.L.'s band when he was only 13 years old, and he's been playing that hill country blues from Mississippi ever since. And it would have been real easy for me to find another white blues nerd music writer to send to Holly Springs, Mississippi to write about Cedric, but that... You know, that does not feel right anymore. So we found a great writer, an actual professor of sociology and Southern culture at the University of Mississippi in the same department where John T. Edge's Southern Foodways Alliance is, named Brian Foster, who, you know, he's a kid who grew up in Memphis listening to 90s hip hop from Memphis, you know, 3-6 Mafia and all those other acts. And, you know, I wanted him to go approach Cedric, you know, to try to bridge, you know, build that bridge between this more ancient style of African-American music, which traces its roots so totally back to West Africa and all over Africa, but Hill Country Blues in particular goes back to West Africa, and bridge that to the hip hop generation. And I just don't think that's a story that I could do, even though I'm a giant music nerd and I know a lot of the music history. That's a story I shouldn't write, because, you know, white folks now need to really open up their ears and hearts and listen to the stories that come from people who are from different races, classes, and cultures. And I just think it's incumbent upon us to do that. And we're trying as hard and as fast as we can to make the Bitter Southerner into a vehicle for that to happen. And it happens with increasing frequency. And if we have our way, it will happen with even greater frequency in the future.
On the Bitter Southerner podcast, loads of comments here. A lot of great, great buzz on social media about the upcoming Bitter Southerner podcast. We just got one from Melanie Harper, said, "This is going to be great," about the Bitter Southerner podcast. A lot of people looking forward to it. Chuck Reese, I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
I am always glad to spend time with Virginia Prescott.
Well, right back at you. Chuck Reese, he's editor-in-chief of The Bitter Southerner. And that is it for our show for today. On Second Thought is produced by Elena Rivera, Leighton Rowell, and the Raven Taylor. Tyler Morse is our technical director today, and Amy Kiley, our senior producer. We also get help from Don Smith. Our theme song is by Alex Crispin and Marshall Ruffin. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thanks so much for spending some time with us today. Have a beautiful weekend. We'll be back with On Second Thought on Monday morning. But you can listen anytime on the On Second Thought podcast, all at gpb.org.